We're ready to get go ahead and get started.
I have 9 o'clock.
I've got 8:57.
What time do you have?
8:58.
8:58. Okay.
Cold morning. Everybody's probably still in bed.
I tell you, I was. I got in late last night.
Yeah.
So, I hear you. I want to formally introduce principal components analysis. We have talked about this in the context of discrimination or classification of two Gaussian distributions, and we actually derived an equation for the optimal decision surface to separate multivariate Gaussian distributions, and that surface was a function of the distance between the means, and then it was also weighted by the covariances and the prior probabilities. Now, what I want to do today, since we're in Chapter 3 and we're talking about how to estimate parameters of a classifier, I want to recast this problem in the framework of a projection-type operation, because we can then generalize principal components analysis into a number of different algorithms that look at this problem of a projection operation slightly differently. So we'll begin with PCA, we'll move on to linear discriminant analysis, and then we'll talk about a few other types of discriminant analysis approaches. So let's first introduce the general topic of component analysis, and this was previously introduced as a whitening transformation when we talked about classification of two Gaussian distributions. We introduced the concept of support regions. We talked about the benefits of statistically normalizing the features and so forth. Component analysis is a technique that combines features to reduce the dimension of the feature space. It is based on the notion of a linear transformation. Sometimes you'll hear people talk about this as an affine transformation that goes by a number of names. And they're all essentially linear transformations, linear combinations. And the reason for that is basically that they're simple to compute, simple to estimate, and they generally result in very tractable results. However, it's important to understand as graduate students that state-of-the-art classifiers has moved far beyond this this kind of work for many, many years now. So maybe when I was a graduate student, you could get away with a thesis on something better than principal components analysis or something, but we're way beyond these projection operations today. But we'll retrace some of this history because these techniques form a basis for some of the more complex classifiers that we'll look at in the context of things like support vector machines and Bayesian analysis and such. So what these operations try to do is to project a high dimensional space onto a lower dimensional space. They essentially try to find the directions that in this high dimensional space. They try to automatically find the directions that focus on either the variance or the discrimination between the classes, and we'll talk extensively about that today. There's three classical approaches for finding the optimal transformation. Principal components analysis, This is a projection that best represents the data in a least square sense. So we will see shortly that this is a transformation that models the variance of the data. And to the extent that variance of the data is the same, is synonymous with discrimination of the data, principal components analysis works very well. And that's why it's been very successful over the years. A more advanced version of that is something called multiple discriminant analysis, MDA. This is a projection that best separates the data in a least square sense. This, as the name suggests, is a discrimination-based approach that tries to directly minimize the error rate. A third approach, independent component analysis, or IDA as it's called, is a projection that minimizes the mutual information of the components. IDA emerged in the mid-90s and generated a lot of excitement because it was focusing on information theoretic approaches to doing this kind of dimensionality reduction and discrimination. And some very nice demonstrations were done that showed using notions of information theory, you could do things like separate two speakers talking at the same time and those kinds, and remove noise and such. And we'll talk a little bit about that this semester. But today we're going to focus mainly on principal components analysis. And then next class we'll talk about LDA. So let's consider representing a set of d-dimensional samples, x1 through xn, by a single vector, x0. So we have d, the dimension of the vector is d, the dimension of our feature vector, and we have a set of these samples, x1 through xn, and we want to represent these as a single vector, x0. So the question becomes, what is the best x0 to represent the data? Now, prior to entering this class, you might quickly say, oh, let's use the x0 that is essentially in the center of the distribution of all these x's. And if you think about that a little bit, you will quickly formulate something like a mean squared error type approach, metric for that. So we can write j sub 0 of x sub 0 is equal to the sum from k equals 1 to n of x sub 0 minus x sub k quantity squared. This is essentially minimization of j will produce the x0 that is essentially the minimizes the mean squared error. It is essentially the x0 that's in the middle of the distribution. And it's fairly easy to show that the solution to this problem is given by x0 is equal to the mean m, where the mean is simply the arithmetic average of all of the vectors. So the sample mean is a zero-dimensional representation of the data set. Now, what is wrong with this approach? We've covered enough in this class that you should now begin to have some intuition about the drawbacks of this kind of approach. So I can think of at least two fundamental reasons why this we might be concerned about this approach. So you can think of at least one.
Does it have to do with our calculation of the mean? With the calculation of the mean?
Not directly. I mean, it doesn't. Yes, I mean, the mean. What does the mean represent when you compute the mean this way? But what does it not represent, I should really say? And we've talked about this now quite a bit.
It doesn't represent the true mean. I mean, it depends on the number of samples that you've taken.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a good way to estimate the mean. It's about as good as you could. Well, it's. So we've talked about things like Bayesian analysis, right? And we've talked about why this kind of a calculation for the mean could be misleading. what is misleading about this calculation of the mean, especially for small data sets?
I mean, for small data sets, it's going to be thrown off a little bit. I mean, it's going to have more variance than if you had a
why?
Data set.
So tell me about priors. If you have this n samples of some random process, and you compute the mean this way, what's going to be dominant in the mean? What's going to dominate the mean? You draw n vectors at random from this distribution. You compute the mean this way. The mean's going to be dominated by what?
The outliers?
No. Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
That's a good line of thought, but not the answer to this question.
Okay.
By the prior distribution of the different classes that you draw. So if you're drawing 60% more, one is.
Yeah, this does not directly think about the probability of the data. Now, it's a good way to estimate the mean, particularly for Gaussianly distributed data, for example. But it doesn't really address the prior probabilities of the data. So when you draw data this way, it's going to be dominated by the prior probability. So the data that you get is typically going to be the most common types of things that occur. So you have the whole sampling problem that you're going to have to collect lots of data to make sure you get a representative sample of the distribution. And we talked several classes ago about ways you can mix information about prior knowledge of the mean with actual measurements of the mean and those kinds of things, right? We talked about that as a parameter estimation problem, ML and MAP and those kinds of things. Now, coming back to the outlier thing, what is the other thing that's wrong? And that the second thing is what I really want to focus on today. When you compute a Euclidean distance like this, and you try to find a vector that sits in the center of this kind of Euclidean distance, what's going to dominate this calculation? So let me give you an example to sort of further, you know, to help you think about that. Suppose you have a two-dimensional vector, and the first dimension of your feature, your first element of your feature vector, has a variance of 1,000, or standard deviation of 1,000, let's say. Same thing. And the second element of your feature vector has a standard deviation of 1. It's going to dominate the calculation. You could pretty much throw away the other elements. Now, that may not be a good thing, because it may be that that other element is really important in discriminating things. It may be that the element that varies with a variance or standard deviation of 1,000, for all classes, it varies that way. It's just the nature of that piece of information. That could be the Dow Jones Index in a stock market example, which, at least prior to the last couple months, used to hover around 15,000. And the other variable could be the price of gasoline, which is $1 or $2. You've got two variables of dramatically different scale. And when you try to operate on them directly, you have a problem that one is going to dominate the other. So we'll show some examples of that today, and we'll talk about this. But Euclidean distances, this is a good approach, but it doesn't really take into account prior probabilities, and it tends to be dominated by the direction of maximum variance, and the direction of maximum variance is not necessarily the direction of maximum discrimination. And that's a point I'm going to pound into your heads over the next few weeks.
say that again?
Good question. I'm going to pound that into your head now. I'm not at that part, right? The direction of maximum variance is not necessarily the direction of maximum discrimination. So just because the Dow Jones Index is a number that varies in 10,000 range, does not mean, it may be that the changes in the price of gas, the 10-cent fluctuation in the price of gas is what's much more important to predicting some outcome than the fact that the Dow Jones Index varied by 200 or 300, right? The last few months, the Dow Jones Index has been varying by 200 or 300 every day. So we'll talk about this more, and we'll end up with using the applet and trying to drive home some of these examples, and it's a lot of fun to think about this. But first, of course, is we have to confuse you with a little more mathematics. So let's try to do this discrimination-based view of principal components analysis. So consider a vector x as being a mean, a true mean, or a mean plus some constant a and a unit vector e. So we're essentially going to describe all vectors as some mean plus some deviation from that mean. So e is a unit vector in the direction of this line, and a is a scalar representing the distance of any point from the mean. So we can write the squared error criterion as a function of the sum from k is equal to 1 to n of the Euclidean distance, but the Euclidean distance now is going to be m plus a sub k times e, where e is a unit vector and m is the mean, and a sub k is a constant that range, that every one of these x's has an a sub k associated with it, minus x sub k. So we're going to write the mean squared error as this function, and we can massage this a little bit. We can group x sub k and m together and put the a sub k times e on the left, and then we can go ahead and expand this norm as the sum of a sub k squared times the norm of e squared, just expanding this term, minus 2 times the cross product between these two, a sub k times e transpose times the quantity x sub k minus m, plus the sum from k is equal to 1 to m of x sub k minus m, the norm of that square. And we can note that the norm of e is equal to 1, since it's a unit vector. And therefore, we can differentiate this with respect to a sub k, and that's fairly easy to do because all the terms that are not a function of a sub k go to 0. And we can write, set that equal to 0, and obtain that the solution of this is a sub k is equal to e transpose times x sub k minus m. That's just essentially, if you differentiate this, this term goes away, this term becomes 2 a sub k, 2's cancel, and you have essentially a sub k is equal to this term. Now the geometric interpretation of this is that we obtain a least square solution by projecting the vector x onto a line in the direction of e that passes through the sample mean. So this gives us a nice interpretation of what this class of operators are going to do when we try to minimize this mean squared error. But it doesn't yet tell us what's the best direction for E. So let's explore that a little bit more. We're going to define a scatter matrix as S, and this is going to be the sum from K is equal to 1 to N of essentially XK minus me minus the mean times XK minus the mean transpose. So this is essentially just measuring the distance. It's a matrix which represents how far each one of the vectors are from the mean of the set of vectors. And this should look familiar because it's essentially just the sample covariance matrix scaled. Now, if we substitute our solution for a sub k that we had on the previous page into our expression for the squared error, we have this quadratic term. And for a sub k, we can substitute we can observe that this is just equal to a sub k, so we have 2 a sub k squared there, and then we have this sum of xk minus m squared. And we can then essentially right, so we have a sub sum a sub k squared times 2 minus 2 a sub k squared. So we have minus sum a sub k squared plus this. And now we can go and substitute for a sub k e transpose xk minus m. And then we can multiply this out as e transpose times xk minus m, xk minus m transpose times e. That's just expressing this as a quadratic form of the form A transpose times B, B transpose times A. And then we carry over the sum of xk minus m squared. And we can then move this summation inside because E is just a unit vector. So we have minus E transpose times the sum from k equals 1 to n of xk minus m transpose times e. And then we have this term, carry this term down. So this we can write as minus e transpose times s times e plus the sum k equals 1 to n of xk minus m squared. So we now have an expression for this error j in terms of the scatter matrix and the vector e. And we need it in this form because we need to ask the question, what is the best direction for E? Well, this form starts to, if you're familiar with Lagrange multipliers, and we're going to use these a few times throughout the semester, but I think the details are something you can study offline if you're really interested in this. But the vector E that minimizes J1 also maximizes the C transpose S times E. Let me go back one. Because we have this negative sign here, so if we want to minimize J, we have to maximize this term. Okay, does everybody follow that? In terms of E, the vector E. We also might worry about m, but m is just a mean. So if we want to minimize j, we have to maximize this term. And the way to do that is to find the vector e that maximizes this term. Well, that becomes a Lagrange multiplier type problem. And you're probably thinking, well, that sounds a whole lot like we're going to be to eigenvalues and eigenvectors. And yes, that's where we're going to essentially get to. So the vector E that minimizes J1 also maximizes E transpose times S times E. And we can use Lagrange multipliers, and there's a link to a nice reference on Lagrange multipliers if you want to read more about that, to maximize this E transpose S times E, subject to the constraint that the norm of E is equal to 1. This is a very standard kind of problem that we solve with Lagrange multipliers. You have a constraint, you have an additional constraint, and you want to mix these two. And the way we do that is to let lambda be the undetermined multiplier. We set up an equation, u is equal to our primary constraint, e transpose s times e minus lambda times this constraint, e transpose e minus 1 is equal to 0. So the idea is that this constraint is essentially equal to 0. We want to find lambda and e to maximize this. So we can differentiate this expression with respect to E, and we can write, well, the derivative of this E transpose S times E, if you differentiate this with respect to E, even though we have vectors and matrices there, this is a quadratic form. This is like differentiating x squared with respect to x. And what you get for that is 2 times s times e. And then the same way here, we have minus 2 lambda e for the derivative of this with respect to e. So we can set to 0 and solve, and we can write that s times e is equal to lambda times e. That's the optimal solution for e. So it follows that to maximize e transpose s times e, we want to select an eigenvector corresponding to the largest eigenvalue of the scatter matrix. So this is essentially what principal components does. We select to determine the direction of E. The direction of E becomes the eigenvector that corresponds to the largest eigenvalue of the scatter matrix. This also suggests other ways we can constrain this problem and find the best E. And we'll talk about those next time as we talk about things like linear discriminant analysis. But for the moment, what we're saying here is that the best one-dimensional projection of the data, and this is in the least mean squared error sense, since our metric was mean squared error, is the projection of the data onto a line through the sample mean in the direction of the eigenvector of the scatter matrix having the largest eigenvalue. And hence the name principal component, because we're essentially finding the eigenvector of the covariance matrix, the eigenvector that corresponds to the largest eigenvalue, and that's the primary direction of our decision surface. Now, for the Gaussian case, the eigenvectors are the principal axes of the hyperellipsoidal-shaped support region. Well, that says a lot, but let's think about what that means for a two-dimensional case. For a two-dimensional Gaussian case, the support region in general looks like what? Two-dimensional Gaussian, where the variances are not equal, you know, the general case, the ellipse looks like what? The support region is an ellipse, I just said that. And it can be rotated, right? So depending on the details of the covariance matrix, we're going to get an ellipse, which is rotated in some way. Now, what does this statement mean with respect to that ellipse? What is the eigenvector having the largest eigenvalue? So if I give you this data, this Gaussian data in two dimensions, you know, we look at the scatter plot, we compute the covariance, we talk about how that we'll see it as an ellipse that approximates that three-dimensional function. The ellipse represents, if you will, the directions of the covariance. What is the largest eigenvector going to be?
Major axis.
The major axis of the ellipse. So, what we see from this is that what principal components analysis is doing is it's essentially looking at the direction of greatest variance. Now, that in its day was a great thing. I mean, this has been, you know, maybe 50, 60 years old, if not older. And that was a great thing. But that was a great thing because you could go into problems like our Mr. Car Salesman, as we like to talk about. We have a story on our website about this. And if you want to figure out what kind of car a customer is going to buy, you want to collect a lot of data about that customer. You want to throw it into a principal components analysis and let it pop out what are the things that are most important to that customer. So this is the Mr. Salesman problem, as we call it. Salesmen are really good at this. You know, they see a woman coming up and they say, okay, I'm going to show her cars that I know women like to buy. They see a guy come up, okay, I'm going to show, they see a high teenage guy come up, right? They say, okay, I'm going to show them all my sports cars. You know, and on it goes. So principal components analysis was very important because it gave us a mathematical way of finding what are the most important dimensions in the problem. Now, you'll notice that it's finding eigenvectors. Let me try to go to the pad here for a second. Well, that wasn't sort of what I wanted. Not quite what I wanted. All right, there we go. So when we have a problem like this, this is our axes. These are actual observables. This might be age, this might be height, or some, or whatever. The distribution of data might turn out to be something like that. The eigenvectors, you're going to get one eigenvector in this direction, then a second eigenvector in this direction. Right? So what the eigenvector is doing is it's essentially taking a weighted combination of each of these variables. So the equation of this eigenvector will actually be something like A1 times X1 plus A2 times X2. So it's producing new variables that are a weighted combination of your input variables. It's not simply just selecting which one is important. It's saying, in this case, the decision is going to be, let's say, 40% X1 plus 60% X2. So you can actually learn about your problem from this kind of an analysis. You can say, well, when a woman walks in my showroom to buy a car, chances are 30% of her decision will be the cup holders in the car, and 20% will be the color of the interior, and 15% will be the trim, or you know, these kinds of things, and auto dealership, automakers do this actually. When you fill out these surveys, and after you bought a product and all that kind of information goes through this kind of analysis, so they can figure out what's most important to you as a customer. Now, this notion of setting up a classifier that looks at maximum variance, this can be rather dangerous. So let me let's now go and play around a little bit. So we have our Java applet. And today we're going to focus on what's called class independent principal components analysis. We're going to use one covariance matrix. And let's begin with a simple case, two Gaussian distributions. These data points were generated using a Gaussian distribution with, I think, a mean of 1/2, 1/2, and a variance of maybe 1. And so the mean here is minus 1/2, 1/2, and the mean here is 1/2, -1/2. So there's a distance of 1 between the means. And this applet does not do Bayesian, so it does not take into account the number of data points in each class and try to estimate prior probabilities. So we're going to ignore prior probabilities for the moment. So what's going to happen if I want to classify this data optimally? Well, you'll tell me, well, there's any number of decision surfaces that could work. I could draw a line this way, I could draw a line this way. All that's really important is that the line be drawn in this region where there's no data between the two classes. Now, what is the principal component solution to this problem? Well, It's actually a little bit surprising, if you will. So let's step through the solution, and then we'll go back and explain what's happening. So the first thing that's going to do is compute the covariance of the data. Okay? And as we said, this is class-independent PCA, so we're going to take all the data together and compute the covariance, which means we're going to get this ellipsoidal region, because if you try to fit the data for these two classes with a single Gaussian, it's got to cover both those classes. And for both those classes, it appears as though there's a big variance in this diagonal direction and a lesser variance in this direction. So the first eigenvector of this, of the covariance matrix for this data, or the scatter matrix for this data, is going to be in what direction? It's going to be actually be on a line connecting the two means, which will be the major axis of this ellipse. So, and that's a reasonable solution in this case, because separation of this data involves looking in a direction that's equal to the direction of maximum variation. So, as expected, we get zero classification error. We are drawing a line that essentially is perpendicular to a line that connects the two means. And only another way that we're finding that line now is to take the scatter matrix and to find the largest eigenvector of the scatter matrix. And these two solutions are the same in this case. Okay. So the principal component solution in this case does a good job. So let's look at the next case, overlapping Gaussian. So here we have two Gaussians that overlap, and we're going to apply principal components analysis to these. So what's going to happen? Well, the first step is we're going to compute the scatter matrix, we're going to compute the covariance. What is the covariance of this composite data going to look like?
It'll look like
a sphere encircling the data, encompassing the data. So let's go ahead and... So there we see the covariance. So now what's going to happen? Now it's a little more interesting, because we have this sphere which is saying, hey, there's all directions are equal. Well, it's still going to put this vector along the line that connects the means. Because if you remember, when we maximized this E transpose S times E function, we're moving the vector E around, trying to find the direction that maximizes the projection of the scatter matrix. So, in this case, it will still compute the means and draw a line, you know, perpendicular to the means and such. So we still get a pretty good solution in this case, but you'll notice now the error rate is non-zero, because the classes overlap, and if we're simply constrained to using a line as a decision surface, which we are with essentially with PCA in this form, no matter how we draw that line, there's going to be some error associated with it. Okay, so that's not too difficult of a problem to understand and sort of predict the outcome. Now let's make things a little more interesting. Let's look at this problem. What's the direction of, if you look at it on a class basis, if you look at this for this class and you ask, what's the direction of variance?
It's horizontal.
It's horizontal. If you look at these two classes and you ask what is the direction of discrimination, you're going to say it's sort of diagonal or vertical. So here's a case where the direction of variance for the individual classes is not the same as the direction of discrimination. However, what's interesting about this case is if you look at the composite data, because we're using class-independent PCA, what is the support region going to look like? Same thing? What do you mean same thing? It's going to be ellipse again, because it's got to cover the whole data with one Gaussian. So actually PCA will do a good job in this case. Because it's going to essentially draw a line perpendicular to the line connecting the means again. And essentially find a line which is along the major axis of this ellipse. Since this is a numerical thing, there's always a little bit of error or deviation here. So that was a little more challenging. What about this case? So again, we have a situation where the direction of maximum variance in the classes, in this case, the direction of maximum variance in the classes is not the same. The upper class has a direction that's horizontal. The lower class has a direction that's vertical. If these classes were to overlap, we could have some problems with an approach like PCA. Because what's PCA going to do? What is the ellipse going to look like in this case? It's still going to kind of span both classes. And in this case, we'll do okay because the means are separated, so it can find a decision surface that gives you a good error rate. As we overlap these classes, though, things get a little more confusing. Now, next let's do four Gaussians, just to generalize this to multiple classes. This is a little harder, because we have now, the first thing we're going to do is the covariance analysis, or the scatter matrix computation. And for that, we're essentially going to get a sphere. Now, what would be a good decision surface for this case?
Just straight down the middle.
Yeah. We'd like a surface here that would split these four classes. So we're going to need two lines to do that. And we do, in fact, in this case, since the classes are separated, we get a pretty good classification on this data. So we can generalize this to multiple dimensions, multiple classes, using intersections of these hyperplanes. And that's essentially what this formulation of the scatter matrix does. It allows us, and we'll see this more clearly when we talk about linear discriminant analysis. Now there are lots of data sets that don't fit these nice examples. One of our favorites is the toroidal case. So what's PCA going to do in this case?
Sphere.
Okay, the sphere, but how big is the sphere going to be?
As big as the outside.
So this is a case where the PCA analysis is essentially, it's sort of like the inner class is going to get immersed or lost in the noise of the outer class. Now, this is a difficult case to separate using a line. So we can sort of predict what EPCA is going to do. It's just going to essentially draw a line at some orientation. But there's no really good decision surface for that you can find here with a single line. Now, later in the course, we'll look at techniques like support vector machines or neural networks that can classify this kind of data. But this is one of the classic cases that you cannot separate with a linear decision surface. So just for fun, let's look at one more case like that. Let's look at the yin-yang case, slightly different case. But the decision surface, again, is not described. You cannot describe it as a line. And we can So it puts all the data together, computes the covariance, and then finds a decision surface. And again, it's just going to draw a line. And it's actually done a reasonable job. It's tried to align the line with roughly with this surface, but because that surface is not describable by a line, there's going to be some error. Now, we can extend the PCA approach into something that's often called class-dependent PCA. And let me just show that by demonstration. Let's go ahead and draw two classes. So here I'm going to have one class. And then here I'm going to have a second class. Now, these two classes are interesting for a couple reasons. One, the direction of maximum variance is horizontal for each of the classes. But the covariance for each of the individual classes is much different than what you would get for the covariance for the classes combined. So if I do PCA on this, well, it's going to fit an ellipse that kind of tries to cover the data, and it misses it sort of misses the second class because it's so small. But it does a reasonable job of classification because ultimately it's looking at a line perpendicular to the line connecting the means. So not too bad there. But this might not generalize well. Because you have reason to believe points out here are more probable to be associated with this bigger class because of its bigger variance. So we can do a little bit better by doing class-dependent PCA. What class-dependent PCA is going to do, this actually goes back to the maximum likelihood classifier we talked about in Chapter 2. We're going to compute the covariances of each one of these classes individually, and then we're going to set up a threshold, a line in the two-dimensional case, that's related to the covariances of the class, the determinants of those, as well as, we aren't doing priors here, but we could have as well done priors. So in this case, what's going to happen is when we're going to compute two covariances, one for each class, and you can see now that we have a bigger covariance here, bigger ellipse for the class with the larger variance. Now, what's the decision surface going to look like if I now try to classify this data? Well, now I'm going to take into account the different variances. So the surface, if you remember, I showed you that picture of all these different decision surfaces in Chapter 2, and some of them were shaped like parabolas and things. What's going to happen here? What is the optimal decision surface here? Well, it's going to be an intersection of these two Gaussians, but they have different variances. So when you intersect them, you're going to get essentially a curved surface. And in which direction should it be curved? I think you had it right. It should associate more data with the upper class, so it's going to kind of bend towards the lower class. No, okay. You're right. It'll bend this way. Because more of this area is getting associated with the upper class because the variance is larger. At least I hope that's the way it works. So it's essentially, instead of a line here, it's kind of bent that line down because the point over here, because of the large variance here, is more likely to be associated with the upper class. Even though you say, well, Euclidean distance-wise, it should belong to the lower class. But when you take into account the variance, it makes more sense for it to be associated with the upper class. So this is class-dependent PCA. Class-dependent PCA is very powerful. And actually, you know, over the years, we've gotten a lot of mileage out of it because these class covariances can do a pretty good job of modeling the data. It's essentially still modeling the data as Gaussian, though. So if these distributions were not Gaussian, you have all the associated problems with that. And it's still, however, modeling direction of maximum variance. It is now trying to discriminate, but next class what we'll look at is a technique known as linear discriminant analysis that goes a little farther than PCA and actually tries to find directly the direction of discrimination, not the direction of variation or variance. Okay, so I think we'll stop here. And we'll pick this up in lecture 9, I guess it is, next class. Okay, see you on Friday.